I decided I'm just going to be who I want to be. And that was a sober lesbian vegan. Take it or leave it.
Hi, I'm Jay Ruderman, and welcome to All About Change, a podcast showcasing individuals who leverage the hardships that have been thrown at them to better other people's lives.
I say put mental health first, because if you don't...
This generation of America has already had enough.
I stand before you not as an expert, but as a concerned citizen.
Before becoming a radio and TV journalist, Jane Velez Mitchell was raised in Manhattan by a showgirl mom and an ad exec dad who exposed her to alcohol at a very young age.
My parents had these big cocktail parties and people were drinking martinis and leaving their glasses around, and I would drink some of the alcohol in the glasses.
After graduating NYU, Jane Velez Mitchell quickly rose through the broadcast ranks, working in Fort Myers, Minneapolis, Philadelphia, and New York, before anchoring in Los Angeles. It was there, at a Hollywood party, that she was confronted by her own battle with alcohol addiction.
Everybody I knew was there. So the next day I woke up feeling incomprehensible demoralization, and I asked a friend who had recently gotten sober for help. And thank God, one day at a time, since that moment, I have not had a drink.
In facing her addiction, Jane realized that it came from not being her authentic self. And from then on, her commitment to being authentic helped make some changes, like coming out on live radio in 2007.
And, you know, the funny part was that it really wasn't that big a deal. As my ex-boyfriend, who we're still good friends, and he had a great sense of humor, he said, "It's worse than that, Jane. Nobody's thinking about you at all."
Confronted with the moral dilemma of industrial animal agriculture, she realized she wanted to be of service to both humans and animals. So she became a vegan and founded Unchained TV, a free network advocating for the health, ethical, and environmental benefits of plant-based living.
You can't solve the climate crisis without looking at animal agriculture. People are just talking about electric cars. The United Nations itself did a report back in 2006 that said animal agriculture is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than all transportation combined.
Jane Velez Mitchell, thank you so much for being my guest on All About Change. Let me just jump right into it. You've had a very storied career. But what I find inspiring about your story is the incredible change in mindset that you were able to accomplish. First, with your choice to get sober in 1995. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with your story, let's start at the beginning. Can you tell us what happened growing up in Manhattan?
Well, I grew up in Midtown Manhattan, directly across from Carnegie Hall, so you can't get more Midtown than that, 57th and 7th. I had a very fascinating childhood. My dad was a Madison Avenue advertising executive straight out of Mad Men, never knew a pair of jeans, you know, drank the martinis and smoked the Pall Malls and had a pipe as well. And my mom was from Puerto Rico. She was a showgirl, a dancer, and she had her own dance troupe, Anita Velez Dancers. And my parents met because my father was a great ballroom dancer. He was Irish-American, and my mom was a professional dancer, and they liked to stop traffic. They'd like to go to these parties back when there were live bands and everybody did ballroom dancing, and you know, people would watch them because they were so good at it. So I was exposed to a lot of cocktail parties as a child. My parents had these big cocktail parties and people were drinking martinis and leaving their glasses around, and I would drink some of the alcohol in the glasses.
When you were finishing off the ends of the drinks of your father and people at the parties, did people understand at that time what addiction was? Were you aware that you could be developing an addiction to alcohol?
Well, my father was a high-functioning alcoholic. I mean, it's a self-diagnosed disease. He's no longer with us. Sorry, Dad, but yeah, he was a high-functioning alcoholic.
Right.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I never got a DUI. I didn't lose the house, the car, the job, but I also followed my father's, I would say, method of alcoholism, which was I never drank before work. I never drank on the job. It was always after work. So I was sometimes hungover. And I went to a party in Hollywood. All my friends were there. My agent was there and her husband and my ex-husband and my current boyfriend. And I started drinking tequila, which was always like the worst thing. I could keep it together if I had Chardonnay, but with tequila, all bets were off. And I, you know, got wasted and went into a blackout. And the next thing you know, I was being taken out of the party. And I was like, why are we leaving? Why are we leaving? And, you know, it was embarrassing because everybody I knew and cared about was there. But that was really good because it kind of, it was like, this is your life. They were all there at once. There was no making it look good. And the next day I got help and that was the last day I ever had a drink. So right now it's 28 years. By April Fool's Day, it'll be 29 years. So I've often said my worst day sober is better than my best day drunk.
Well, first of all, congratulations on that. That's a huge accomplishment. Did someone say something to you like, Jane, you need to get some help? Or was this something that you just came to and you said, I need to make a change in my life?
No, I think only your good friends, your true friends will tell you you have a problem. A lot of my fair weather friends were like, oh, you were fine. Don't worry about it. It was fun. But there were a few true friends, like this friend of mine that I went to college with who had gotten sober himself, who told me, you know, you've got to stop drinking. And first I said, you're not my mother. But after that experience, I called him up and I said, you're right. I'm turning myself in. That's literally what I said. And I find that in situations like this, only your true friends will tell you. But you know that you can't drag anybody into sobriety who's not ready. It's literally only the person who has the issue can declare that bottom hit. So that's the nature of addiction. The nature of addiction is there's a substance or a behavior you can never successfully negotiate with. And the only power you have is the power to not negotiate at all, to walk the other way. And so it's a dichotomy. The power is in admitting you're powerless. I was very blessed that after I had some clarity and I was able to see, wow, okay, this is life on life's terms. Sure, there will be dark moods, but you don't have to drown them out. You can just sit through the feelings. They don't last forever. And so after having some clarity, I made some big changes in my life. I realized that one of the reasons that I was drinking was to suppress my sexuality. And I came out as gay. And that was another miracle, getting sober, coming out as gay. And then what I did afterwards is realize that I have certain values. I like to consider myself a compassionate, kind person. And I decided to align my behavior more with those values. So I became a vegan and I started to do work to wake people up to the horrors of industrialized animal agriculture. All of that would not have happened. None of that would have happened had I still been drinking. And so I was really able to restart my life on a much better footing and be present and figure out who I am. And I have this as a refrigerator magnet. Oscar Wilde says, be yourself, everybody else is already taken.
Right.
And I think that's one of the best statements because we're, well, I'll speak for myself. I was trying to be whatever my father wanted me to be, my mother wanted me to be, and society wanted me to be. And I decided I'm just going to be who I want to be. And that was a sober lesbian vegan. Take it or leave it.
Right. Can you talk about coming out and why you came out? And you came out at a time where it wasn't like it is today. It wasn't as accepted. And what was the fallout from coming out?
I was one of the first on-camera TV journalists to come out. Now, I didn't do a deep dive undercover investigation into this, but there may be people before me, but I don't know too many. Okay. As far as especially lesbians, okay? So what happened was I fell in love with somebody, a woman, and I was living with her. And I was also doing some freelance work at KABC Radio. And I was co-hosting with this, what they call a log cabin Republican, which is a gay Republican. And we were talking about Senator Larry Craig, the toe-tapping senator who was caught in the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport bathroom and who hotly denied that he was doing anything but going to the bathroom. But it was the topic du jour. A lot of people were talking about it. And so we were talking about that. And you know how radio is. It goes on for hours. It's TV, you'd have a 2-minute or 3-minute segment. We were talking about this for like an hour and 45 minutes. And my co-host was talking about how he came out to his mother and blah, blah, blah. And I was just starting to get this horrible feeling of hypocrisy. Here I am, sort of talking about this other person's alleged hypocrisy. And I'm living with a woman and I haven't told anybody publicly about it. So at that moment, I had like a crisis of conscience and I felt icky. I called my girlfriend at the time and I said, turn on KABC Radio. I'm going to come out. So after the commercial, I did. I came out. I said, well, you know, I live with a woman and I don't even remember what I said after that. And, you know, the funny part was that it really wasn't that big a deal. As my ex-boyfriend, who we're still good friends and he had a great sense of humor, he said, it's worse than that, Jane. Nobody's thinking about you at all. So I think a lot of the fear that I had, huge fear, first of all, to tell myself that I was gay. I gave it the old college try, heterosexuality. I was married. I dated men. And I'm not saying I had bad relationships. And I can say that, however, despite all that, I'm gay. And it took a lot of basically, well, therapy and getting sober. Once I didn't have the alcohol to hide behind, it became harder for me to lie to myself. Once that was taken away and I had to live life on life's terms, I literally started realizing, why do I want to go through my life like lying about such a key aspect of my personality? I don't think it's about sex as much as it is about being true to who you are. Again, as Oscar Wilde said, be yourself. Everybody else is already taken. And I think that the courage to be myself resulted in me coming out. And I'm very happy I did. Sure, there was some gossip. But then when I actually came out, I was just freelance. And I'll be honest, it helped me come out that I was freelance. If I had been under contract somewhere, it might have been trickier. But I was freelance, and so I took the opportunity.
So I want to transition to talk about your choice to adopt a vegan lifestyle. Was that in response to your addiction and how you dealt with your addiction, or how did you come to that decision that you're going to lead a vegan lifestyle?
Well, I kind of grew up in a pescatarian household. My mom, who's from Puerto Rico, was a pescatarian. And my father, who was, you know, had grown up on corned beef and cabbage, switched. We thought we were vegetarians, but we weren't. We ate fish, we ate eggs, we had dairy. And it wasn't strict, like if dad on Thanksgiving might grab a slice of turkey. But we never had meat in the house growing up. It just wasn't something. We never cooked. Neither of my parents really knew how to cook. We went out to dinner every night, most nights. And I guess that helped me get on the journey. I did not grow up thinking that nobody's trying to force me to eat meat. I do remember going to a friend's house when I was a child, and the mother had served tongue. And I sat down and she said, here it is. And I said, I'm not eating that. And I remember all hell broke loose because I didn't want to eat that food and I didn't eat it. And so I was aware that that's a tongue, you know, of somebody. I don't call them things, somebody. And so as I moved on in my career, you know, when I was drinking, I was like, I love animals, but I didn't really do anything. Then once I got sober and I moved to Celebrity Justice, that tabloid show, and let's face it, celebrities hate tabloid shows. So we were trying to get celebrities to talk to us. Very difficult. They would literally run in the other direction. So I called PETA up and I said, look, you have a lot of celebrities who care very deeply about their issues. Maybe you could get some of them to talk to us. And that's exactly what happened. I worked with PETA to get celebrities who literally would push their publicists aside because they were so passionate about a particular issue involving animals. And we won a couple of Genesis Awards, which were from the Humane Society of the United States. And the top example of that was when I got Robert Redford to talk to me. And I was in the morning meeting, driving there. We had a 7 a.m. meeting, and you had to be dressed with three-story ideas at 7 a.m. in Glendale, which was a drive for me. And I'm there driving to work, and I hear Natural Resources Defense Council is opening up a new green building in Santa Monica, and Robert Redford is going to be there to inaugurate it. And I thought, wow, I had just gotten a letter, one of those mass letters that celebrities send out, from Robert Redford talking about the military sonar impacting the whales. It makes them crazy. It drives them crazy. The sonar just destabilizes them. So at the meeting, I said, I'd like to go interview Robert Redford. And I was told, well, if you get a one-on-one, you can do the story. Now, you know how hard it is to get a one-on-one interview with Robert Redford without, you know, any plan? So I drove to the Natural Resources Defense Council building, and I said to the guy outside, I said, look, I'm on your side. I'm an environmentalist. Help me out here. He goes, he's coming in the backside. So I go in the back. I hide behind a dumpster. I had a wireless mic. My photographer was hiding behind another thing. Sure enough, Robert Redford pulls up looking every bit the movie star in a red Thunderbird convertible. And he hops out and I said, Mr. Redford, I got your letter about the whales. And he just looks at me and he just walks in the building. So then we all assemble for the news conference on the rooftop. Now, this is what a nice guy he is. He walks by me and he goes, Miss, I'm going to answer your question about the whales. Just let me do this news conference. So they do the news conference. I'm kind of hanging around the building, pretending to videotape whatever's green, but I really want to get Robert Redford. His publicist wants him to have nothing to do with us. So he's doing interviews with all these big networks. And finally, he comes out. And I say, Mr. Redford, he goes, yes, let me tell you about the whales. I got a one-on-one, like, seven-minute interview with him talking about the whales and military sonar. And I was quite revved up by that point. So finally, he goes, what do you think of the whales? And I said, I'm devastated. I think about them all the time.
Let's talk about society. If you're watching TV or you're any type of media that you're consuming, you're seeing advertisements for, you know, fast food, for hamburgers, alcohol. There are commercials all the time for alcohol all over the place. All of these things that lead to addiction, overweight, obesity, alcoholism, people ruining their lives through gambling, it's out there. It's pervasive. How does a person combat that?
Well, you raise a great point. And I even wrote a book called Addict Nation, to make the point that we live in an addictogenic culture. There is no better customer than an addict. And we have created an addict nation. And look at fast food. Two-thirds of Americans are overweight or obese. That's food addiction, plain and simple. And of course, the fast food giants have figured out that our bodies are pre-programmed to crave sugar, salt, and fat, and high caloric food to get us through times of famine. And so they pack that food with sugar, salt, and fat, addictive substances that we crave. And no wonder that people eat them and then 45 minutes later, they want to eat them again and they can't stop, right? The power that you have is the power not to go into a fast food restaurant. As one of the diet doctors we have on our Unchained TV network said, if it's in your house, it's in your mouth. Mm-hmm. So again, as an alcoholic, I'm not going to keep alcohol around. As if you're a food addict, don't go into a fast food restaurant. Don't keep junk and fast food in your house. Stay away from it. The only power you have is the power not to touch it. Once you touch it, all bets are off.
Right.
And so the people who are selling this stuff, the 0.1%, they don't care if we get sick or fat or get diabetes or heart disease or cancer. We know the World Health Organization has said that processed meat is officially cancer causing. Now, nobody talks about that. They don't talk about it on the news. They don't talk about it anywhere. But if kids were sitting around smoking cigarettes all day, you'd be darn sure somebody'd call child services. but people are shoving these nuggets and these junk food and these fast food items down their kids' throats, even though processed meat is officially cancer-causing. Nobody talks about it. So we've got a conspiracy of silence. That's why I started my streaming network, to get the word out. We're an all-volunteer, Unchained TV is all-volunteer. And we're just trying to wake people up that they have the power 3 times a day to change the world and save themselves. You don't see a lot of commercials for apples and carrots on TV. The billions of dollars are not there to be made. So people don't want to encourage you to eat healthy fruits, vegetables, nuts, grains, and legumes. We need to wake up to the huge catastrophic impacts that the fast food industry and industrialized animal agriculture are having on the rainforests, on habitat destruction, wildlife extinction, and as I mentioned before, human world hunger, preventable lifestyle diseases. There's a solution. And of course, it takes a while. For example, when I went vegan, which was shortly after I got sober, so about 27 years ago, maybe 28 years ago, I just gave it up. Boom. After I talked to Howard Lyman, the fourth generation cattle rancher who went on Oprah to reveal the horrors of his industry. And I did an interview with him and he came up to my cubicle afterwards. I was at Paramount Studios working at KCAL TV. And he said, "I hear you're a vegetarian." I said, "Yes." And he said, "Do you eat dairy?" And I, of course, I stopped because he had just told me about all these cows have to be pregnant. People don't realize milk doesn't just happen naturally, that the babies have to be taken from the mother so we can steal the milk. The boys are turned into veal calves or shot or left to die. The babies go, I mean, it's a horror show. So I hung my head and I said, "Yes." And he went right to my finger, liquid meat like that. That was the moment I went vegan because he confronted me about my hypocrisy. He said it straight clear, like a 1 second intervention. And I thank him. Just as I am grateful for my sobriety, I am grateful for that man confronting me. Again, the truth, telling me the truth in a nonviolent but confrontational way. And, you know, about a month and a half later, somebody accidentally put some cheese on my salad, and I used to love cheese, and I went, oh, God, that tastes horrible. My taste buds had returned to their factory settings. It takes about a month or maybe 3 months. There's a reason why rehab is at least 28 days generally, but sometimes 3 months, because it takes a while for the body to rid itself of toxins, to rid itself of sort of those program cravings and get back to what you really are as a person. So you are what you eat.
What do you say to someone who is like, this is too hard, you know, to make a hard stop and to say, you know, I'm moving away from this. This is just too difficult. How do you answer that?
Well, it is difficult. Anything worthwhile is going to be difficult. And it's a really a mathematical calculation at the end of the day. Are you going to be happier continuing with that habit and looking and feeling the way you do? Or are you going to be happier taking the path least traveled and finding another way where mind, body, spirit is in alignment and you wake up every day feeling energized and ready to go out there and experience this temporary life of ours? That's another thing I say to myself every day. This is a temporary experience. Do I do it perfectly? Hell no.
I want to get back to your profession as a journalist. How did you first get into the field and what were you looking to do? What stories were you looking to cover?
Well, I actually was, talk about teenagers, I was pretty much the same person I am today, protesting. And I was the kid outside leafleting outside the high school building. And I would attend a lot of protests and marches. And that was, of course, during the time of the Vietnam War, all the uprisings. And so I was interviewed quite a few times by reporters. And I said to myself a couple of times, I could have done better. Those questions were not good. I could do better than that. So when I graduated from high school, I went to NYU and I just literally checked off broadcast journalism. And I didn't think a whole heck of a lot about it. So I went to New York University, graduated, and I got a job in Fort Myers, Florida. And I got a job, and then I immediately after about a year and a half there, got another job. I wanted to move up. And so I moved from Fort Myers, Florida, which was a tiny little town where nothing really ever happened, although adorable, to Minneapolis, which was the worst culture shock. I've been all around the world. It was 45 degrees below zero with the wind chill when I arrived, and I had been hired over the phone. Imagine going from Fort Myers, Florida to Minneapolis in the dead of winter.
That is a big difference.
And then I went to Philadelphia, and I spent a couple of years there. I was always an anchor reporter. And then I got a chance to come back to my hometown, and I worked for 8 years at WCBS-TV. It was really great to be back home. And I lived there for 8 years, reporting and anchoring. And I was kind of over it, because when I grew up in Manhattan, it was a lot of good times and parties and fun times. But when you're covering crime as a crime reporter, which most local news reporters are pretty much crime, that was, you're seeing parts of the city and things that are, I mean, I saw dead bodies on the street. And so after about 8 years of that, I got an opportunity to be a weekday anchor here in Los Angeles. And I jumped at the chance. And I had the best time. I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. I had a nice parking spot on the Paramount lot, and I'd walk around and I'd see people in costume. I mean, it was one of the most fun times. And I worked there for about 12 years as a reporter and anchor. And while I was there, I ended up covering the Michael Jackson child molestation trial in Santa Maria, California. And I ended up being Nancy Grace's reporter. She had a show on CNN Headline News at the time. And this was a trial that the whole world was obsessed with. Hundreds of media from around the world, fans coming from all over the world to watch this trial.
Rumors swirled around Hollywood after two of Jackson's homes were searched over the weekend by Los Angeles police. Police sources confirm allegations of child abuse are being investigated.
And I was on every night talking about it with Nancy Grace. And after the trial, the show ended right around the same time. And so at one point, I was just sitting here. The show had ended. I didn't have a job. And somebody called me and I said, hello. And they said, hey, how would you like your own show on CNN Headline News? I said, absolutely. And they said, good, we're going to call it Issues with Jane Velez Mitchell. And I said, great, because I've got a lot of issues. And I got on a plane, went to New York, went right to my mother's house, because CNN was literally two blocks away at the Time Warner Center in Columbus Circle. And I moved in with my mom, who was in her 90s by that point. You know, when I got hired, I said, would you mind if I did a little animal segment once a week? And they said, no, we don't see a problem with that. And I started doing my animal rights once a week, every Friday. And it was amazing. I mean, it was so wonderful to be able to do reports on things that I cared about, along with all the other stories, which were primarily crime. And I'm not a crime buff. I'm not that obsessed with crime. I don't watch crime shows. But the idea that I could do something that was close to my heart once a week really made me happy. And then as soon as that ended, and I had a nice run, they gave me all my social media. We left on great terms. I was appreciative. I thought I was going to be there for 2 months. I was there for 6 years. I decided now's the time. It's probably the end of the run professionally. So let me start doing what I really care about, waking people up to the need to show compassion to other beings on this planet. And I've turned it into a nonprofit, and now it's a streaming television network, which is almost 2,000 videos, documentaries, cooking shows, talk shows, just everything you need to know about the environment, about climate change, how we have the power to literally reverse climate change through our diets. I will say, it's the last thing I'll say, I'm not going to get on my soapbox, but The New York Times just recently published an article, you can look it up, about an Oxford University study that showed that heavy meat eaters, which is most Americans, the average American eats more than 66 pounds of pork a year. Heavy meat eaters can reduce their greenhouse gas emissions footprint by 75% by switching to a plant-based diet. Now, to my point, do you think any other media picked up on that? No. So they'll do what I call catastrophe porn all day. people dying in floods and car accidents because of the heavy rains and the houses washing into the ocean and the fires and all that. They'll play that forever. But when there's an article in the paper of record that explains that we could all reduce our greenhouse gas emissions footprint by 75% by switching to a plant-based diet, do they cover it? No.
So, Jane, you're incredibly honest about what you've gone through in your life and your career, which is very refreshing because I don't encounter that, you know, all that often. But give us some insight. Someone who's listening, who's looking to make a meaningful shift in their life, you know, in their diet, in their lifestyle, career, their activism, how would you tell someone to make a significant change in their life and stick with it?
Well, first of all, I don't want to put myself up here like, oh, I'm the person with all the answers. Like I say, I've made a ton of mistakes. And I feel like, well, one of the keys to sobriety is you talk to somebody else who has the same problem. So there's an equality there, and it's not one person above the other. So I'm not coming from any lofty pedestal where I've got all the answers. Far from it. But I could only share what's worked for me is I feel that being of service and trying to stay out of ego, very hard. We all have egos. I have an ego. You know, it's in the hard drive. You can't totally get away from it. But trying to be of service to others and also to look at our own behavior and see where changes can be made, where we do less damage, cause less suffering. And it happens to me a lot. Like I was uploading videos for our global streaming network, Unchained TV, and we decided to create a sustainability category. And I'm uploading all these videos about composting. And after I looked at the third one, I go, I'm a total hypocrite. I'm uploading videos about composting and I don't compost. So I said, you know what? I got to start composting. So what I did was I took a tin, that nice big tin that is in my refrigerator, and I started just taking, you know, when I stripped the kale, putting those in, the banana peels, all of that stuff. And then I asked the building to get a green bin, which turns out is required by law in Los Angeles. So we have a green bin in the back. And I started composting. And the next thing you know, the guys who do all the foliage around here started using it. So it's filled with the foliage when they rake up and trim. And then I saw other neighbors started doing composting. It turns out composting is a lot of fun. I had looked at it as, first of all, I hadn't really thought about it. But secondly, I kind of thought, well, that's not for me. You know, I'm an urban dweller. So I try to set aside my preconceived notions. And you know what? I enjoy composting. I have a lot of fun with it. It makes me feel better about myself that instead of just putting all that in a landfill, which then would contribute to climate change, that we put it in a composting bin and hopefully it doesn't go in the landfill because, you know, sometimes I wonder, where does this all go? But that's just a small example of how I have to call myself out a lot about my own behaviors. And to be honest with you, cut out the violence. Killing animals is violence. Our society has told us, okay, there's animals you can care about, dogs and cats, and maybe horses occasionally. And all these other animals, you don't have to care about them. Their suffering doesn't count. Cows, pigs, chickens, turkeys, goats, lambs, you don't have to care about them. Their suffering doesn't count. Guess what? That's a lie. Their suffering does count. And we have to become cognizant of the fact that if we're biting into a piece of meat, that was someone who had a mother, who had a father too, who undoubtedly, probably, unless it's chicken, chickens are killed at 45 days, you know, pigs are killed at 6 months. Babies, I bear witness to pigs going into slaughterhouses. There's something called the SAVE movement. And it's based on the philosophy of Leo Tolstoy, who said, when you see suffering, you have a moral obligation not to turn away, but to get closer, see if you can help, and even if you can't help, to bear witness. And so there's a whole movement based on bearing witness called the SAVE movement. And people gather outside slaughterhouses, and when the trucks stop, they say, we're so sorry, we love you, and sometimes they can give water to the animals who have driven for many hours or even possibly a couple of days without water and food. And they're terrified, they're babies. When you look into the eyes of those pigs, I defy you not to be moved. They are talking to you. They're like, where am I? Why is this happening? Where's my mother?
Right.
It's soul crushing. And I urge everyone, if you think there's nothing to it, go to a vigil. And, you know, one of the big moments we had with our nonprofit was when Joaquin Phoenix won one of the big awards. I believe it was the SAG award. And instead of going to the party, the after party, he went to the vigil. And we had a reporter from Unchained TV there who interviewed him about why he chose to go to the vigil instead of the after party. And that got picked up everywhere. It was in Vanity Fair. It got picked up by Entertainment Tonight. And that was a big breakthrough moment for us as a nonprofit news media organization. And so people are starting to wake up to this. And you know, here's the bottom line. Trees absorb carbon. We all know that. Photosynthesis, right? That's how they get the leaves. They take the carbon in. So because of animal agriculture, either to create cattle grazing or to grow crops to feed to 80 billion animals, people don't realize 3/4 of the soy that's produced is fed to farmed animals. We have destroyed a lot of forests to create land to grow crops and cattle grazing land. We've given planet Earth a buzz cut, and we are currently destroying the Amazon for cattle grazing and to grow crops to feed animals. So all of that land is not absorbing the carbon that it would be if that land still was forest. So what we are proposing, and there's an organization called the Plant-Based Treaty that is urging cities, Los Angeles has endorsed it, and various other cities around the world, is to basically transition to a plant-based culture, reforest that land, and that would immediately begin to start absorbing a lot more carbon, and we could start immediately bringing the Earth's temperature back to where it was prior to the Industrial Revolution. And it's the fastest way to do that. So we're saying you can't solve the climate crisis without looking at animal agriculture. People are just talking about electric cars. The United Nations itself did a report back in 2006 that said animal agriculture is responsible for more greenhouse gas emissions than all transportation combined. So why is it that people are talking about electric cars, but they can't talk about diet? Well, look at the TV commercials. That's the answer. I mean, it's as plain as day. Nobody has to come up to your office and knock on your door and say, don't talk about this. Obviously, you look at the commercials and you go, I'm not going to say anything. That's why I started my streaming network. I mean, I kind of feel like I've been working my whole life up to running a streaming network. I've worked at networks for more than 30 years. I was there. I know how it works. So now, through my nonprofit, we've started our own streaming network, and it's global. It's not available in China, but pretty much, you know, throughout most of the world, people can watch Unchained TV, and it's totally free, and people can just get the information. So if they want to find out about this, they can watch Eating Our Way to Extinction, which is an incredible documentary. We just got McLibel, which is a documentary about the longest trial in England, two people who stood up to McDonald's. We have vegan cooking shows. We won 2 taste awards with our vegan cooking show, New Day, New Chef, which has a lot of celebrities. Even Billie Eilish does a cameo in the show. So, you know, we're working around the clock. I'm working just as hard as when I don't take a paycheck for this. I'm doing it as a labor of love, because how can I sit around and whatever, play tennis and sit on the beach while we are barreling toward a climate apocalypse? And that's not me saying it. Sir David Attenborough has a great documentary that's on Netflix, I believe, called Breaking Boundaries. There's only 9 boundaries. Once you cross them, there's no going back. We're already breaking through 6 of them. Just yesterday, I read an article about the ocean currents could be monumentally impacted by the melting of the ice caps. Fresh water is warmer than salt water. And so it's going to cause all sorts of very intense changes. And I'm reading this article. When could it happen? They said, no kidding. Anytime between 2025 and 2050. It's like, this is not a joke. It's going to happen. I just read an article yesterday. Mexico City could run out of water. I mean, we're on the precipice of some really bad stuff. And here's a solution that could turn it around. And not only is it not covered on the mainstream media, but the government is subsidizing the very industry – that is the problem. The dairy industry would collapse without government subsidies. Completely collapse, because kids are not drinking milk. In fact, they try to force them to in public schools, and they say, if you won't drink the cow's milk, just throw out the containers. So here we are torturing all these cows so that kids can refuse the milk and throw it into the garbage. You know, that's morally wrong. We need to wake up. If we consider ourselves good people, we have to include this in the equation. And I'm just urging everybody, please, for your own self-interest, look at the possibility that we have a point.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for being my guest on All About Change. We've covered so much. You've had such a varied and impactful life. But what I'm taking away from this, and what I think our guests should take away, is that they personally can make a change by adopting a different lifestyle to save our planet. And thank you for that message. And thank you for everything that we've talked about today. So thank you so much, Jane Velez-Mitchell, for being my guest on All About Change. Such a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you. And I hope everybody takes an opportunity to download Unchained TV.
Jane Velez-Mitchell's energy and drive is truly inspiring to me. On top of her extensive career as a broadcast journalist, she's also a New York Times best-selling author. She continues to be an outspoken advocate for animal rights and environmental sustainability to make the planet better for all of us, and her work never stops. That's it for today's episode. Join us 2 weeks from today for my conversation with someone whose activism has lasted as long as his career, actor Ed Begley Jr. Today's episode was produced by Rebecca Chasson, with story editing by Yochai Metal and Mijan Zulu. To check out more episodes or to learn more about the show, you can visit our website, allaboutchangepodcast.com. If you like our show, spread the word, tell a friend or family member, or leave us a review on your favorite podcasting app. We'd really appreciate it. All About Change is produced by the Ruderman Family Foundation in partnership with Pod People. That's all for now. I'm Jay Ruderman, and we'll see you next time on All About Change.
Au revoir, but not good.